My name is Michael Coates, and these conversations highlight the challenges, achievements, and societal issues within social housing. In this episode, we speak with a Housing Trust CEO who specialises in mental health. We speak about her early life in British Guyana and how being a child carer to a disabled dad and brothers shaped her life. We also talk about how she came to the UK and what drives her today. This podcast was created by Combat Pest Control in partnership with Covardis Trust. Episode 1, Ingrid Tennessee. This is Breaking the Cycle. Ingrid, where were you born?
I was born in a little area called New Amsterdam Burbies in a country called Guyana in South America. And my area was called Paradise of Thieves. It was named Angois Avenue, but informally Cow Dam because of many cows living in the area. We were also a shanty town and very much on the outskirts of that area.
Mm. So what was day-to-day like? And just to get kind of a picture of the area, was it brick buildings? Was it kind of, what was the setup?
Gosh, there were zinc little huts and wooden structures on stilts, some were on the ground. We didn't have roads. We had dams and mud tracks because it wasn't an area that was developed. So lots of squatters lived in that area. So it was very crowded. The animals lived with people. So people lived in the little shacks or in your little huts, and the animals were just outside. Sometimes the animals would come in. It was an area that didn't have electricity. And if you wanted electricity, you couldn't pay for it. So you basically stole electricity by merging the wires from the main lampposts on the main road, which was about 600, 700 metres away. So you had to be very agile in thinking how you could get electricity and how you could run your wire without the authorities learning of it. We also had standpipes where we used to go to a point at the main entrance to the road coming in from the town. And you used to fetch your water in old paint cans and old buckets, anything that could hold water that wouldn't leak. And if it leaked, you'd get chewing gum, you'd heat the chewing gum, and you'd just fill the buckets or the saucepans to make them hold the water.
So it was a third world country? Would it be classed?
Yes, Guyana is a third world country. We were known as the breadbasket of the Caribbean at one time. So we're geographically in South America, but our norms and mores are more Caribbean. Where Guyana is the Amerindian word for land of many waters, and the Amerindians were the indigenous people. So Guyana is made up of six races. So the Europeans, the Africans, the Indians, the Chinese, the Portuguese, and the mixed race. And the mixed race was an amalgamation of the various, Africans and the Indians, or any of the cultures just mixed. And the Amerindians tended to stay by themselves more in the forested areas. They didn't really come out to the populated areas. And people live mostly on the coastal plain in Guyana.
Mm.
And we're bordered by Brazil, Venezuela, Suriname, and the Atlantic Ocean.
Talk a bit about kind of coming together then. How did your mother and father meet?
My mother came from a very wealthy family of pharmacists, and they owned a lot of the properties in that area. My father was from the village, an area called the Quarantine Coast, so quite a distance away from the town area where my mom was. My mom lost her parents at quite a young age, so her mother's sister took her and her sibling, a brother, to live with them. And so my mother lived with her extended aunts and uncles, and she became the carer for that for her older cousins. My father moved from the country to live in the town to work at the local mental asylum. And he was a very charming, very good-looking man. So he used to pass what they called a drugstore, or the pharmacy as we would know it. And he used to see my mom in there at the back. And when he set eyes on her, I think he decided, this might be a good way for me to move from where I am to some wealth.
Or was he poor?
He was very, very poor. But my mother's family did not really know the depth of his poverty, because he used to dress really well. You didn't have money, but you had a suit. So when he passed where she was living on his big Ben or bicycle, he used to make sure that he was dressed very smartly. And so he charmed his way into my mother's grandmother's heart. And then he said he said he wanted to marry her. And I think that the family thought that if my mom was married out, then she wouldn't have any claim to the estate of her late mother and father. So she got married to my dad and he took her to the countryside. And I think my mom had a terrible culture shock because she had to then gather firewood for cooking. The area was often flooded out. She had to walk barefooted.
Did the family not support your mum financially?
No. Once my mum was married to my dad, that was it. And then she went to live in the countryside. So to come to the town where her family lived, you had to get a taxi and you had to pay for that. Of course, my dad couldn't pay. So once my mum was up there, she started, that family quickly came along. She was pregnant very quickly, one after the other. And from what I understand, three siblings died, either a full term or during pregnancy. Mm. And that was because my mum was always struggling and probably not looking after herself during pregnancy. So once she started to have kids, more and more she became distanced from her family.
And Dad, was he still at the...
He worked at a mental hospital. And then, so when he came to the town to work, he stayed at friends and, various people. And my mom stayed at his home to look after his ill parents because his parents were ailing too. So my mom became carer for his family too. And it was much later after my eldest brother was born that my dad brought my mom to the town to live in a little cottage. And she would go and see her family, but my dad wouldn't. He stayed away because I think the family thought that he was below their level and they didn't really want anything to do with him. So whilst they acknowledged my mom, he was kind of like an outcast.
Like a peasant.
Yes, he was, very much so.
Oh, no, I didn't mean it that way, but he was thought of by the family.
Yes, absolutely. He was looked down on, because he wasn't seen to be ambitious. He was working there. He was, it was a menial job, a psychiatric nurse. You didn't earn very much money. And my mom was a housewife, so she used to get handouts from her family.
And then children, you mentioned.
Yeah, so she had my eldest brother and then a few pregnancies in between and then lost those babies. And then two other brothers who are now, I now know when I came to the UK, that they were suffering learning difficulties. In Guyana, we were ostracized because they were thought to be mad people because at the time we didn't have good medical care and diagnoses and so on. So if you weren't normal.
Before we get there, so you got your older brother, then two... Disabled brothers.
Yeah, two disabled brothers, then another brother, and then me. So I'm the last of five children, surviving children, the only girl, and I wasn't a planned pregnancy. Mm. I was, I came very, when my dad was about 45 and my mum was about 40. So I was a late addition to the family and not planned.
When you were little, very little, was it happy?
I can't remember. I cannot put my hand on heart and say that I had any happy memories of my early childhood because my mom was always ailing. And when my dad was around, children were seen and not heard. So you wouldn't come to where your parents were. You were out in the yard playing, and it always seemed like it was a hustle and a scramble because at a very young age, I had to be fetching water. I had to be getting up at 6 in the morning to feed the chickens, to look after the animals, to clean the yard. So the time to play were snatches of what I'd say happy moments when you were with some of your friends. But you were always called away because every family in the ghetto thought that they were the better family, so they didn't want their kids mixing with the other kids. So you were always sneaking off to play with friends and then getting called back quite quickly, not only because your parents didn't want you mixing with them, but also because you had work to do. There were chores to be done.
Your dad had an accident when you were 5 or 6.
Yes, I had, I was in the yard in the morning, early in that morning, and I was fetching water, I think it was, and a piece of green heartwood pierced the bottom of my right foot. So one of the neighbours took me in a donkey cart to the accident and emergency area, which at that time was the general hospital. Everything was done at that hospital. And I was standing there looking out on the road and I heard a siren. And you don't often hear the ambulances because that is when something really dire has happened. And I was standing there and I look and I think when I saw the stretcher come out and I saw my dad on that stretcher, he was on a night shift the night before. He started work at 10 and he was due to finish at 6. But what we were made to understand is that he went to one of the solitary wards where one of the patients were really unwell in isolation. And my dad was attacked by this patient. So what we didn't know at the time was that he was lying in that ward until the morning shift came. So when I saw him coming out of the ambulance, this was as a result of him having been attacked at some point in the night, hit very hard in the head with a chair and other objects that this patient had. And my father went into the hospital. I remember my mom just being squirreled away by somebody who wanted to find out details about my dad. I was sent with someone to go home, and the details, it was a very traumatic occasion, because I thought I saw, you know, my dad was wrapped up. I couldn't tell if he was alive or if he was dead. Nobody was saying anything. It was like shushing the kids away, you know, shush me away. Somebody took me home, and I didn't see my dad for 18 days because he was hospitalized. When he was discharged, he was a vegetable basically and confined to bed.
So when you had your dad, the accident happened, and then for all intent and purposes, your dad had gone.
Yes. My dad came home and he was, you know, living, if you picture where we're living in this shack, zinc roof, water leaking through there, you know, not a very nice place. And then you have somebody who's disabled now, who is confined to bed. You have to find, so we used to get the fibers from the coconut and we used to put them together in sacks that were stitched up to make mattresses. So we had to get one of those, mount them on four pieces of wood with kind of like a trestle. And that's where my dad was. That was his bed in one of the rooms that I shared with my mom and my two brothers. My other brother was in another room. But when my dad came there, it was like he could look at you and he could mumble. But he'd suffered a stroke whilst he was in hospital. So he couldn't really speak. So you couldn't tell what he wanted. So he was doubly incontinent, unable to say what his needs were. So you almost had to read what he needed. And I was, from that age, I became a carer, a full-time carer for my father, because my two disabled brothers weren't able to do anything. My other brother had to go out to start fending, because my dad was the main breadwinner. So he was, my fourth brother was going out to fend for food and so on. So I was
the one just older than you?
The one just older than me, yeah.
And you were six at this time?
Yes, right. About six. And so whilst caring for my dad, I also had to help my mum, because I think combined pressure of the years of, the stress of having so many kids together, probably suffering, stillbirths and babies dying. She just went into some, I now in my adult life realize that she was probably very, very depressed. So she wasn't able to cope. She was always unwell, always in bed. So, you know, calling on me to look after my dad and my other brother. And it was a very... it was very demanding, but it was also a very confusing time, because as a child, you're wondering what's happened to your parents. You're kind of bringing up yourself on your own. You have to fend for yourself. You have to fend for these other people. And as soon as you try to run off to go and play with your friends, you have to come because your dad needs cleaning or changing or washing. And we didn't have a bathroom. We had a zinc on stilts that we used to go down the, we call it steps, from the stilted structure. We'd walk down and there was wood leading from the bottom of the steps to the latrine and to the what we call the bathroom. So my dad couldn't go there. So we used to hold him around his waist. But at this time, he'd lost a lot of weight. And we used to take him out onto what we call a landing, which is the area just immediately outside the door. And this little platform, which led on to seven steps to the ground. And so we took that onto the landing and we put some plastic around there, have a bucket of water from what you would call a river here, but for us, we call it a trench because it was just a ditch where water gathered. And you'd get the water. Sometimes a little fish would run out of the water, but you'd wash him. You know, you didn't have, there was a soap called a Zex soap or a Lifebuoy soap that, sometimes if we were lucky, we'd have one of that. And you'd have to wash him with your hands. So you never got rid of the smell. Or if he weed, it would be on the mattress and the cloth. So any old cloth, anybody throwing out cloth, you'd stitch that together and put that as the sheet on the bed. But because it was a hot climate, you didn't have need for quilts or anything big. So you just something to throw over to stave off the mosquitoes or the flies, which were quite often around because not only of the smell, the heat, but you can imagine not much ventilation and being in a place like that. So having to wash Dad and make sure he was clean of infection was a challenge.
Did you have people around you? Was there a strong community? Were people coming in and out and helping?
No, there was a strong community, yes, but everybody was fending for themselves and they'd offer sympathy and, you know, they'd bring a few mangoes or a few vegetables or fruits from their garden and so on. And they'd come and sit and chat. We're famous. The Guyanese people are famous for coming together and you sit down and you have a good old laugh and a chat and you moan about life and you expound on the virtues of life. But not everybody would come and help because, I mean, it was kind of like a situation where nobody wants to clean poo and pee. So they'd sit and look at you and say, oh, you poor thing. Oh, you're doing really well. Oh, love you. I'm going to bring a mango for you. Or when I cook, I'm going to bring some food for you later. But it was kind of like at a distance. But I loved that kind of like camaraderie because it was, you know, there's a saying that misery loves a company. The elders would sit there and they would talk and lament and bemoan the fact of their position in life. But it wasn't a very ambitious community because it was where you lived. You knew your place. You stayed there. Once you could survive and you could live off the land and your animals and so on, it was okay. Mm. If you had a relative living abroad, then that was even better because you had easy money coming in. You know, we didn't have that. I had some extended relatives who would maybe at Christmas time send some money, and that was a massive thing for us because then my mum would bake what's known as the Guyana rum cake, lots of rum. Guyana has a lot of rum, and everything was a celebration with rum. And when you had money, everybody knew because you'd share, you'd buy food, and you'd cook, and you'd share. And you know, it's you don't expect anyone to help you physically. You know,
was there a welfare state as well?
There was a welfare state, but it was very, very. I mean, the money that you got was minimal. But I don't remember at the time that my dad got any money. I remember when my dad passed away that my mom got what was called social security benefits, which would have been $60 a month, which would equate to probably about a few quid, less than a fiver a month. But while my dad was off work and sick, he used to get a very, very small, what did they call it, sick benefit. And that amounted to nothing. So my brother just before me, he and I used to go out and we used to scavenge. So we stole what we could get. We stole and we sold back to the people. I'm not proud of that now, but one had to do what one needed to do. I loved fishing, so I'd catch fish for supper. I'd go out and scrub floors and wash people's clothes or look after their kids or clean their yard to get a little bit of money. And my brother did the same thing.
What age was this? What age was you start earning money?
Just after 6, 7, 8. But by the time 10, from about 10, I was really adept at it. I knew what I needed to do. I knew how to do it. I'd honed my skills of working and knowing where I could get money. So scrubbing stairs and kitchen floors were the best because they were oily and grimy and dirty. So you knew that if you offered to scrub somebody's floor there, that that was where you'd get a little bit more money. And if I offered to read with the younger kids, I'd probably get a bob or two. A bob was 25 cents. A bob was great money because then, you know, if you got the chance, then you could go to the cinema and sit in pit. And pit was the area, the lowest area in the cinema where they said there were loads of bugs and cockroaches. But I loved it because that was where everyone could, you know, you could shout and scream if the electrics went out. You could, you know, and every time something happened on screen, you got very much involved as part of the audience. So it was good then in terms of, working, getting money, doing what needed to be done. A quarter pint of oil, I remember, a quarter pint of oil, half a pint of rice, 2 ounces of butter, and I loved peanut butter. I used to stand at the counter and look at the man who was selling, Mr. Soman was his name, and he'd look over at me and I think he used to tease us. He'd get that big spatula and he'd go into this massive bucket of peanut butter and he knew he wanted 2 ounces, so he'd just ladle up a whole big dollop. And then he'd just put a little pinch on that greaseproof paper to give you. But that was the best because you could get your money and go to the shop and you buy a quarter pint of oil, you buy the rice, the sugar, the flour, because then that would make something. We called it, well, pancakes here, but we used to call it dosa because you just put it on a fireside on the zinc. You mix it up with some sugar and some salt and you ladle it out there and then you put some peanut butter on it. And that was like Christmas dinner for us.
You mentioned a second ago about reading to children. Was education an important part for your family or yourself? What was the relationship with schooling?
Well, my mum always aspired to be a pharmacist because of the family she came from, and she was really bright. So she used to always talk to me. She used to recite rhymes, and she used to talk to me about, education being the door to opportunity. And whilst she didn't really help me, she always used to say, education, education, education. And I realized at an early age that education was a way out of poverty. And so I decided that I was going to read. So I used to, we had big Shell oil drums. And when the petrol stations didn't need these oil drums, people like us would go and we'd get an oil drum and you'd boil and boil water and throw in with bleach and everything to clean it. And then you'd leave it to catch the rainwater because that was like a gold nugget. But when it was empty and in the process of being ready for rainwater, I used to go and sit in there and I used to escape in there. So I had my Enid Blyton book and I used to lose myself in these stories. And that's where I developed the love for reading. And when I read for the little kids, my favorite book was The Magic Faraway Tree. And I used to read to them and talk to them about the saucepan man. And I used to talk to them about being at the top of the tree and finding the rainbow and that it was sweets everywhere. And the little kids used to love it. And of course, if I entertained kids that were, whose parents were actually working, and when I say working, it'd be like working at the cafe or the restaurant or digging up the roads, then they'd give me a 10 cents or a 5 cents. And that was great money because I could buy an ice pop. And I knew that if I got their trust and confidence and their kids were with me, that I could go and borrow books, I could steal books, I could come back and just entertain them. But I loved it too. And it was a great way to start an education where, you know that that would get you out of that area.
And was there formal schooling?
Yes.
Did you go to school?
Yes, yes. I started my first school at a place called Vrymenshoven, which was not far from my house. And so that was my primary school. And I did the 11 plus exams because we were British Guyana. So we had an educational system much like the British. So I did my 11 pluses and then I got really high marks. I didn't get to the top school, but I got to the second best, which was Burbys High School. And that's where I started my secondary education. I was in the debating club. I loved school. I loved my first English teacher as well. Teachers are really important to, people in getting kids to either like school or not like school. And my English teacher was a great teacher. So I loved English and literature. She got me into the debating society. And so I was at school. And just before I wrote the equivalent of GCSEs, which would have been the Caribbean Examinations Council exam, my dad passed away. I mean, he suffered a massive heart attack and he died. But I was there when that happened. And I remember very vividly because I was preparing for exams. My mom had gone out with one of my brothers. And actually, incidentally, while she was out there, she got robbed because she had a great big, we call it bangle, but it would be in a bracelet, which was the only piece of jewelry she'd had from her parents left. And that was her treasured item. And she was robbed then because I later found out when my dad, I was with my dad at about 6 in the evening and he just started really going into palpitations. And I screamed out and called a neighbor. But what we used to do was just sit on his, kind of like rest on his chest with your palms. And I didn't quite know what giving CPR was, but we used to try it. And I was trying what I knew to do, which would be clasping my hands and my two hands together and just bracing down on my palms and counting to 6 and lifting again, counting to 6 and trying to breathe into his mouth. And he was a far away gone and neighbours came over. Some gave him Epsom salts to drink. Another lot gave him sugar water because it was things that you tried to, we had our own remedies. Anyway, when he passed away, I was just about to do my mocks. And I did my mocks and then the headmaster for the school that I went to, I said to him, I really needed a job. I had to start working now. And because I was a bright student, he offered me a teaching position as an assistant. So I wasn't formally trained, but I moved through that and I was studying part-time at the the University of Guyana extramural classes. So I started doing sociology and...
Oh, okay. So just before I interrupted you there for a reason, I just want to go back to your dad.
Mm-hmm.
You said, I mean, this had been, he died in 83. So yes. It'd been over 10 years of being, living, existing really, and you guys really struggling and surviving. I hope this is not a crass thing to just to come out and say, but was there any relief that he'd gone?
Yes, of course. As a full-time, you know, as a carer, as a young carer, you want freedom. Sometimes I used to think, why am I trapped? And I used to say this to my mom all the time. I used to cry oftentimes and I used to say, what's the matter with us? Why are we so poor? Why don't we have enough food? Why don't we have all these little things in life? And my mom would say to me, a goat didn't bite you. And I used to wonder what that meant. And what it basically in Creole slang is, if a goat bit you, it meant you had bad luck. You were poisoned for life. And she used to say, a goat didn't bite you, so don't consider yourself as having bad luck. Basically, you should be very lucky for what you've got. But I used to think, why couldn't I go out with my other friends? Why couldn't I have the things that they have? Why couldn't I have a dad that worked and a mom who wasn't unwell all the time? And why did I have to look after my two disabled brothers? You know, I was kind of like their keeper. I had to, you know, kids would come from school. We lived along the route where there was a school. And the kids would come, new kids would come and gawk at them, stare at them. Kids would throw stones at one of them, the one who was able to speak, because one is profoundly deaf and can't really speak. He's monosyllabic. And the other one has a severe speech impairment. So the kids would tease him because then he'd go off into a tirade. And so, you know, I used to often wonder, why is it this way with me and my family? Because there are other families in the area who were doing reasonably well and didn't have what I call the malady of two sick brothers, a sick mom and a sick dad. So when dad passed away, yes, you grieve and so on, but there's a little part of you that you feel guilty for being relieved, because then you don't have that, you know, and I'll be really blunt and, you know, I'll say it. You don't have that smell. You don't have that, you know, you're not living in that filth and that where urine and poo is always constantly there, because now people can go to the latrine or they can wash.
Was you embarrassed?
Yes, of course. I was incredibly ashamed of my home. I couldn't bring kids to my home. So when my friends from school used to want to come to where I lived, they used to, I used to bring them to a certain point and tell them to wait. And because my house was always dirty as well, you know, because so many people living in a very confined place with all of this happening, you know, and we had dogs and cats as well. We had a couple of ducks and a sheep, and, you know, ducks make a hell of a mess in the yard. And so you have it downstairs and then you have it upstairs and then you have it indoors. So I would never bring kids to my home.
Which is, it sounds just the way you explain it, it's very oppressive.
Yes.
You explained it very well and just been very oppressive and very all-consuming. This need to consistently, especially as a young child, just look after and avoid maybe bullying from kids and not being, no, a kid wants to be different. They want to blend in.
Yeah. Yeah, we were very much ostracized. People used to say to my mom, why didn't she tie my two brothers up to the guava tree in the back so people wouldn't see them and hide them away from when people came in? So I remember when people used to come to us, like the doctors, Western doctors used to come and sometimes they'd practice with my brothers, giving them Lagactyl and tablets and so on to help them in what they saw was the madness and when it was full moon. And so when they came, I used to have to usher my two brothers outside to the back of the house and take them down the back steps and wait by the side of the bathroom. Sometimes you used to hide at the side of the bathroom and look until they left before you came out.
To hide them?
Hide my brothers.
And what did you mean full moon?
Well, my brothers were thought to be mad because there was no diagnosis of learning difficulties. What my brothers have are severe learning difficulties, both of them, and speech impediments. And one, as I said, is profoundly deaf. But at a time with no proper diagnosis, if you were other than what society deemed normal, then you were mad. And so at full moon time, you were deemed to be crazier and you'd do more odd things and weird things. And interestingly enough, I used to believe it because my brother Neil used to start, you know, he used to come out and he used to swear. But also I wondered too whether it was because of teasing that he actually responded to teasing and to people taunting him, that he got frustrated and started swearing. So it was this kind of like self-fulfilling prophecy that full moon time, he's going to be mad. So he is mad. But maybe it's his frustration. He was shouting back at them and so on. And so we were told that at that time, my mum had to doubly medicate him with Lagactil or any of the other pills.
What was that? Like a sedative?
And Lagactil is a very strong sedative, yes. And I imagine, not being a medical expert, but probably aligned it to diazepam or Valium. And so giving him that would tranquilize him. So they were zombified, my two brothers, because every time a new doctor came in, they trialed new pills on my brothers. And my mum was only too happy to take her two boys, as she called them. You know, she'd merrily march them down to the hospital where these new doctors were. And they were like two specimens, these boys. The doctors would examine them and would say, oh, well, let's try another set of pills on them. Oh, let's try this. And my mum was only too happy to. And we had these brown envelopes where the pills were in. And I wonder how she even differentiated, because we didn't have electricity. We used kerosene oil lamps. You know, we didn't have any drawers or anywhere to keep them. So one can only imagine and, you know, be daunted at what those boys actually had when all these medication were mixed up, old and new, expired and unexpired, you know, just to keep them calm and to keep them tranquilized so that they wouldn't get into tempers or harm people.
Doctors are seen as high, you know, this higher purpose. And did you have respect for them, or was it a case of these are the bad guys coming in to...
My doctors. So because we were so poor, doctors and lawyers, well, we always aspired to be doctors and lawyers and pilots, because those were seen to be the dream careers. So doctors were gods. If a doctor said something, you'd be like, yeah. My mom used to say, yes, doc, no, doc, oh, doc. And, you know, and whatever the doctor said, my mom held
never
on
questioned.
To. Never questioned. Never questioned what the priest said, because we used to go to church every Sunday too. You know, so these were, these professionals held stations in society that were very, very highly regarded headmistresses and headmasters. You know, you had this pecking order in the community. And especially if the doctor was a foreign doctor, oh my goodness! Well, they're better than good. They're absolutely extolled, you know, because they're from abroad. They must know what is right. Of course, they love, because they spoke in such a lovely, soft way when they were talking to my mom. She always fell for that, and I used to want to be like them when I'd listen, because they'd give her their attention as if she was the most important person there. Yet they were probably 100 people waiting in the outpatients to be seen and what we call the infirmary. And then they'd send you to the dispensary, you know, for the medication. And they'd say to my mom, oh, if you go there, you don't have to wait very long. And as soon as you get home, make sure you give them the tablets.
Do you ever, I want to move us forward quite to this very moment.
Yeah.
And then I'll bring us back to teaching, because that's when it kind of, that's mm-hmm. almost getting this very interesting in many respects for your career. Do you reflect back now, and if you do you empathise with your mum? Do you sympathise with her? Are you angry with her? What's your now relationship with your mum? Because we haven't spoken about it too much, but
I have to empathise with my mother, knowing better now. Of course, because she didn't know any better, and she trusted who she thought were the experts, the professionals. So I totally empathize with my mom, rest her soul. When she passed away, you know, and I spoke to her, because she'd always said, when I die, I want you to give those two boys a dose of cyanide each, because nobody would be able to look after them as I have. And the doctors understand me. I understand the doctors, but you young people wouldn't know what to do. And so I said to her when she passed away, and when I paid tribute to her, I said that I promised her that I'd look after them. But what I also didn't say aloud was, I'm never going to make them take medication the way they were given medication so carelessly. So I embarked on a journey of detoxifying them from all those medications.
What year was this?
This was in 1998, May of 1998, when my mom died. I had to bring them to the UK because there was nobody there to look after them. So I had come to the UK by that time to live.
Teaching. So you mentioned about these professionals and this kind of aspiration, really, to teach.
Yeah.
And we kind of got to the point where we were heading towards courses at university. Did you enjoy the teaching process?
I loved teaching. I wanted to go to university, but I wanted to be a journalist. So, but I couldn't afford to go to university. I was doing part-time training, and I just was aspiring to do far better than I was. I wanted to move out of that area, and I wanted to go and live in a big city, Georgetown, but I just never had the opportunity. By that time, we had something interesting because we weren't into arranged marriages or anything like that. But there were lots of opportunity where if you wanted to leave the country to go to a country like America or Canada or Britain, not Britain so much, everybody wanted to go to Canada and America, then you'd find somebody from over there who would be coming looking for a wife or a husband to Guyana. And I bought into that idea and I thought, God, why doesn't anybody come and propose to me? Why doesn't somebody from abroad come for me? And my mom would say, because you have two mad brothers, nobody will want to marry you. So I started teaching in 1984, and in 1992, a Guyanese chap living in London was looking for, he'd just suffered a terrible breakup from a long-term relationship with the love of his life. So somebody advised him to go to Guyana and find a wife. And he asked his aunt to look for some possible candidates. And she asked my mom, and I said, yes, I'd do it because I wanted to get out. I wanted to get out of poverty. By that time, one of my brothers was suffering with hydrocele, and I'd taken him to the hospital, and the doctors kind of like were so horrible and said, you know, he's mad. We can't treat him. We don't know how, you know, he can't speak. We don't want him in here. And at that moment, I thought, you need money to exist here. And more the idea of getting married to leave the country was cementing itself in my mind. And so when this chap was looking for a wife, I threw my hat in the ring. I was very blunt. I said, if you take me, you have to take my two disabled brothers and my mom, who's very sickly. But I'd work to earn my keep. And he actually said yes. So it was a very quick, rushed thing. I got married in August of 1991. He came back to the UK and I followed in January. And the reason why I didn't go right away was because I was scared. I waited until almost the last day for the plane ticket to expire. And then I took the flight on the 13th of January and arrived in London to a very cold London day in 1992 and didn't know. I was wondering, where are all the people? Why is it so grey? Where's the sun? And it was a big culture shock.
I'll generalise, right? I can look and have looked down on things like arranged marriages. And you've mentioned there, this is not a cultural thing. This was more of a convenience or a way out. Mm-hmm. And it also sounded very, for the first time, really, for me, it sounded very empowering. It sounded like you was taking responsibility for something. It sounded like there was an absolute, like someone would get a job and move abroad. Mm-hmm. This was a transaction that was taking place. Was there love in the relationship?
No, because you don't know the person. You know, I didn't know him. He didn't know me. So he wanted someone. He was told, you know, just go. He was in love before. And so when he wanted this, this transaction we had was, he said to me, if you come to England, I'll marry you. You work to help me. I want kids. And I said, okay. So he said, you have kids for me? And you stay. And he said, you'd find a job. Maybe you can go and work at Tesco or Sainsbury's or so, you know. And he said, I'll do my job and hopefully we'll learn to love each other. But I wasn't attracted to him at the time. He wasn't the kind of person that I would have, you know, been with. But he was a kind man and he was a good man to me because from the time he married me, I think he always said it. You're too ambitious. What do you want to do? Rule the world? And I said, no, I don't want to ever be poor again. You know, so I went looking for a college on my the first day I landed here in the evening. I was saying to him, where's the nearest college? And he told me. So I ventured out. But then I got lost just around the corner because all the houses looked alike. And the next day I was down at Lewisham College. I registered. And then I started working at a doctor's surgery. I asked a person who asked someone else who said, you could never do anything but work in a doctor's surgery or be a carer. At the time, I didn't quite know what carer was in the UK. Mm. You know, it was a more professionalized term to what we were doing back in Guyana. So I started work at a doctor's surgery as a receptionist. And I was still finding out where else and what else I could do. And through meeting people coming to the surgery, I found out that Lewisham Hospital was looking for lab assistants. So I moved across there. In the meantime, I was pregnant. I had three kids very quickly. So my first son was born in 1993, then the second one in 94. I had a miscarriage in 95. I had a child in 96. And I remember when I went to the doctor to say, I don't want to have any more babies. He told me off and said, you need to have, your husband needs to come here and talk to me. You can't be coming and telling me you don't want any more kids. So that in itself was oppressive. But I was on a journey and I was learning and I was in the West now and there were people at work I was talking to and people at college and they were advising me. And it was really, really empowering. And I felt that I was moving away. There was a distance between me and my husband when I was married anyway, but there was more and more of a distance because there was this man who wanted someone to be a stay-at-home mom and just work, you know, now and then. But I was thinking, hell no, I'm going to go to university. I'm going to, you know, further my career in journalism.
Even when you was a young mom and you've got these little ones around, and that in itself, you know, I've mentioned oppressive. Three young children in a short space can be oppressive, especially when they're two and three and everything's on you, but they become these little human beings and they start taking a path of their own. Did you still feel in control then? Did you still feel like there was this ambition or was it all about the kids and then in a few years I'll figure it out? Or was it constant as you were going through?
I think it just, for me, it was kind of like... I kept growing. I was like, I felt like I was less, for want of a better word, an onion. I was peeling, layers of me were falling off and then there was more coming out and I was more and more I was becoming ambitious because I didn't want my kids to have, not to have the opportunities I didn't have. So I decided that I wanted my kids to have the best life, the best opportunity. But what scuppered that, what sent me back into a really bad place was when my mom died in 1998. I had to bring my two brothers over. So they were living with me now and this husband and then these three boys. My youngest son was about two. And it was a really difficult time. How I managed, I look back on it now and think, how the hell did I manage that? Mm. Social services were really kind and graceful to me. I had a very good social worker through my then boss at Lewisham Hospital who said to me, your brothers could go to a day center. So, but I was always living on alarm clocks and watching the time because it would be, I'd get up early in the morning, have to look after my three boys, when my brothers came, get them ready for the day center, you know, leave my three boys, two to school and one, I think, was with his grandmother who was helping me, his dad's mom, helping me to babysit. So I was rushing off to work. Then I was going to evening classes. I was coming back. You know, oftentimes I'd get into bed at night really exhausted, but I powered through because I knew, you know, I had really good people around me at work and at college saying, you can do this. And I had good friends who were now supporting me here with my kids. And some of those friends are still alive and I love them and I'm indebted to them for always, you know, and when they pass on, I don't know how well, you know, I'll be
a lot of years to go with that. The home situation when you had your brothers and your boys, was there a relationship there? Was there any negative or did you ever feel like anyone was in danger either way or was it a family?
It was a family. It was my brothers were very fiercely protective of my kids. And my kids used to help me to wash my brothers because I used to have to shower them, cut their nails, wash their clothes and so on. And my kids would help me with them. So my kids were young carers and carers, Lewisham, were very good in helping me to take my kids on Saturday trips and so on. So I had lots and lots. Unlike when I was in Guyana, when we had people coming and talking and not doing. In England, I had people doing. I had people, friends giving me money. I had friends helping me to take my brothers out, my kids out and so on. So it was great. So my husband was very much in the background, didn't have to do anything. Many times, probably, you know, he was very gracious, but I could imagine how he was feeling because he always used to say to me, well, if I want to talk to you, I have to go look in your diary, you know. So,
I mean, it was like a hectic time.
It was.
Towards the end of the 90s, you'd studied, become a counsellor, is that right?
Yes. So I start, as I said, when I came to the UK, I started studying and I graduated as a person-centred counsellor. And then I moved on whilst working and whilst bringing my boys up. I studied for a master's in addictions And so I moved from the hospital. I moved on to hostel work at a place called the Alcohol Recovery Project. And that was my opening into work in addictions. And that gave me the drive for going into studies to do a master's in addictions. So I did clinical and public health aspects of addictions. And that really augmented the work that I was doing practically at Frontline, supporting first and second stage dry houses. But whilst doing my master's, I had to leave my organisation because it was becoming too demanding with the kids, with working part-time and studying. So I then started working at the Deptford Reach Day Centre. And when I qualified, I was just about to qualify with my master's, but there was a really good job that came up at Hexagon Housing. I applied and then I became a project manager for that mental health supported housing unit. And I was there for about 4 years. But in the meantime, I thought I could get into the Metropolitan Police as a graduate.
Of course you did.
So I went to do special, I was a special constable and I loved it, but it wasn't moving fast enough for me. And then I thought, well, what else? And somebody said to me, oh, you should go into politics. And I thought, oh God, but I just thought, the more experience you can gain, the better, because it's all about growth, professional and personal. So I was a councillor with Seven Oak District Council from 2010 to 2015. But then I started really focusing my energies because I was headhunted by my current organisation for their head of operations post. And I think that was the making of me, because I went to an organisation that was really struggling, that was selling itself as a mental health specialist supported housing organisation, but we weren't doing specialist work. We were getting paid, but it wasn't, I felt that we weren't really focusing on our purpose, which was to support people to recover and to maximize their independence and to move back into the community to be meaningful citizens.
So let's move, that's 2015. You first went to Co-Vardis Trust.
Co-Vardis Trust, yes.
So what, in 2015, what was it? What was
So in 2014, I met the CEO for Co-Vardis Trust, and he told me he was struggling, with the services. And he said he had a position coming up. So I thought, okay. So I decided to go across it because I felt I'd met my ceiling limit at Hexagon and there was more I could do. And there was something else I was looking for. So when I went across to this organization, it was the ideal place because it was where I could really blossom and use my skills, my counseling skills, my master's in addictions, all my years of lived and learned experience to really support my clients into meaningful recovery and to offer interventions that would really support them through their journey of recovery. So I started there, but then unfortunately it was a tumultuous year for the company. And so in about August, they advertised for a CEO and I went through a very rigid and strenuous process and came out being offered a job in October 2016. And from then to now, I have been the CEO of Co-Vardis Trust.
And so Co-Vardis Trust, you house?
So we are a housing association. Our target area is in Lewisham, but we work in five other boroughs. And we're supported accommodation as a regulated provider. So we're a company limited by guarantee, a charity and a housing association. We're regulated by Homes England. And we have a care home, so regulated by a Care Quality Commission and, of course, the Charity Commission. So we have currently 195 clients, 10 in the care home and 185 dispersed across Lewisham and Croydon. And we're focusing, so we have three pillars to our strategy. The first pillar is a professionalisation and specialisation. So we're working to professionalise our staffing. We're working to ensure that our systems and processes are professionalized and that we offer the best possible service through good evidence-based practice, through good practical interventions to help our clients. Our strapline is maximizing recovery, supporting, maximizing independence, supporting recovery, and building on community resilience. And that is encouraging and supporting our clients to move back into the community. The second pillar of our strategy is diversification, because we want to make sure that we can offer more in more boroughs. And these are surrounding boroughs to Lewisham. So Lambeth, Southwark, Croydon, Bexley, Greenwich, because we feel that there's need out there for our services and we want to be the best provider of supported accommodation in offering a holistic service that augments the core support of tenancy sustainment.
Mm.
And the third pillar is client development. And we've only just reviewed our strategy in October 2020, where we thought that we must focus more on our purpose, which is to support our clients through offering the best possible support to encourage them when they get back into the community, they're prepared for probably a route of study into work or volunteering into work and maximising their potential to enjoy life as best as they could.
If we look at mental health, and mental health sometimes gets a bad rep, sometimes it's known for poor mental health, and a lot of people have good mental health. Just to understand a little bit more, are some of your clients, the residents that live and thrive with you guys, are they, or can they be in poor mental health when they arrive? And is it about then increasing that and building on something to get them into good mental health? And then, because you mentioned community again and again there,
mm-hmm.
and then bringing people in so they feel part of something societal, not just something, you know, with their curtains closed in their own.
Yeah, well, you know, research shows that sometimes that one in three of us would suffer a mental health and wellness or have suffered or is suffering poor mental health. And, you know, poor mental health is not about a severe illness. Sometimes it could just be mild anxiety, mild worry. Sometimes it could be loss. It could be migration. There's so many factors that could cause someone to have poor mental health. And when our clients come to us, they come from, we accept anyone, when I say we accept, we welcome anyone above 18 years old who, through a situation in their life, have become vulnerable and so would need our supported housing services and our service delivery to help them to navigate that path of recovery so that they could be reintegrated back into the community. So sometimes people come in with different levels. We have a 24-hour service where clients come in and they need that 24-hour support to help them to with their medication regime, help them to look after themselves with personal care, help them with interventions that would add meaning and structure to their day. Then we have other levels of service in the dispersed out at our sites where clients could be referred directly from what we call the mental health or vulnerable adults pathway to our services. So what happens when they refer to us is they're assessed for the level of need. And that's the kind of service we place them in, whether it's 7 hours or it's 5 days a week or it's just floating support where they live in their own flats, but we float in and out as is needed. And what we offer is we get paid by housing benefit. So central government has this pot of money where housing benefit is, it goes to local councils. And if you're a regulated provider, you get enhanced housing benefit for offering additional support on top of core housing benefit. So there are two elements, the housing benefit element and the enhanced element, which is what we are meant to use to help clients with tenancy sustainment. But we all agree and we all know that tenancy sustainment alone will not help someone to navigate and traverse their path of towards recovery. What they need is they need a more holistic approach. So we look at the psychological, the emotional, the physical, the whole of well-being, and we tailor our support packages to work with our clients in a collaborative manner where our clients lead their support and care package. And it's what they want is, what we do is dictated by what they want. And we work with multidisciplinary partners who could be either statutory or third sector out in the community, like the psychiatric nurses, the care coordinators, the GP, any other therapist or medical professional involved in their life, family and friends, and any of their other networks. And what we do is we combine all resources to tailor the support package based on the needs of the client. And we promote positive risk taking. And that is, sometimes a client may not want to use the bus because they've got a fear, they've got a phobia, or they've been in hospitals for so long that their confidence levels are low and they're not really sure how to go out there and negotiate or, you know, buy their tickets and so on. We help them to get past that fear, get past that worry, and to take a positive risk to mitigate for any of the worries or the anxieties that they'd have were they to go out there and push past that barrier that they have to, you know, getting what they want.
Something so small but can have such a massive impact. And we sometimes look at this as like a slope, like a there's one point and there's another, and we have to get from that. But if we start looking at things like a step, and you stay on one step for a period of time, and then there might be a sharp incline. That sharp incline might be getting on the bus and using a debit card or whatever it is. And this sharp incline is sharp for that individual, and some are sharper than others. And then you go on you plateau for a little bit and you're on the step, and then you come up. Instead of a medication that might take you from one place to another. Now, there's a purpose for medication, of course. Uh-huh. But what you're saying here and what I'm hearing is a more of a social prescription, more of a community-based prescription.
Absolutely, absolutely. Medication is not the be-all and end-all of it all. We believe that it's got to be a social prescribing model to help people, because people are not just individuals who need medication. You know, they have they've had relationships before they've come to us. They've had interests before they've come to us. You know, they have medical issues. There is so much that makes up an individual that you have to work on every aspect of that individual. You're talking about financial, environmental, family, social networks, medication, food. You know, everything. Sometimes our clients have, when they come in, they have diabetes, they have high blood pressure, they probably have lost their members of their family through breakup or, you know, through bereavement. Probably they've moved away from their area of origin for one reason or another, and that's had a detrimental effect on them. So you can't just give a person medication and just let them be. It's got to be so much more. What we like to think is that with our client development as a pillar of the strategy, is that we're focusing much, much more on psychological, emotional well-being, on people eating well, people exercising, learning about the benefits of this, learning about why they have blood tests, learning about why they should comply with their medication regime if they have one, learning why they should be, you know, monitoring what they eat, what they drink, how they sleep. Sleep is a really important thing when you're looking at maintaining wellness, because if you're, you know, if you've got a dual diagnosis, which is perhaps an alcohol addiction and substance misuse addiction, and you're on medication and you've got a mental health and wellness, you have to learn about contraindications of different medications. You have to look at your diet. You have to look at lifestyle. And we really believe that a person is not just one element. You've got to take the whole of being into consideration when you're looking at helping that person to rehabilitate back into meaningful life.
So tough to, if you're in it, and you know, you spoke several times today about being in something. You know, the last time you said it was when your mum died, and there was almost an overwhelm.
Mm-hmm.
But then there was people around you ready to do and to support.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it takes. I don't know how people can be in the absolute depths solo and get themselves out of it.
You need people. We need it.
Need a society, an understanding, an empathetic society to come together, and a community to come together.
Yes, and you need resources. You know, more and more third sector and voluntary sector and charities like ourselves are taking on much more responsibility than sometimes what the statutory sector is able to offer. But we believe we're in this because we're passionate. I am passionate about helping people to move back into having some semblance of normality, some kind of fulfillment in their life. And you can't do it alone. You've got to have other people. You've got to have, you know, we've got to be this, you know, mental health is everybody's business. We talk about safeguarding well-being of people and children, and we talk about child protection, but there's adult protection too. We have to protect people and look after them around us. We have to care. There's you know, there's an element of care that's missing a lot of times from people around us. You know, we have to be understanding, we have to be patient, and we have to be compassionate, and we have to want to make a difference and to do it for the right reason. There's so much more that society can do for our people who are vulnerable because of one thing or another in their life that's caused them to be at this position where they're unable to fulfill, you know, live a meaningful life and be fulfilled.
We're very empathetic and sympathetic to the 3-year-old who, or the 5-year-old in your case, who, mm-hmm. not to put words in, but was potentially lonely and neglected. And mm-hmm. and I think that's safe to say that you may, that's what I was thinking about when you were talking earlier on. Mm-hmm. And then in a more severe situation in this country where, you know, the 3-year-old is abused, mm-hmm. we're very, very sympathetic to that mm-hmm. 3-year-old. Yet the 3-year-old gets older mm-hmm. And might get into trouble and then might get into addiction.
Yeah.
And then we start becoming angry towards that person and the person becomes demonized.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe you're right. You're absolutely right. We need to be more compassionate. Mm-hmm. And we need to understand and we need to educate ourselves that the 3-year-old will eventually turn into the 23-year-old.
Yes. And we need to stop being judgmental, but also we have to put our money where our mouth is, because we cannot just pay lip service and say, yes, we want to do. You know, there's supposed to be this paradigm shift that we would equate mental health and wellness the same as, you know, a parity of esteem between mental health and wellness and physical and wellness, but that's not being done. There's a lot of talk around it. But what we need is less reliance on medication alone and more input into the whole of person package. And I'm talking about looking at where people are living, looking at support networks, looking at where they can access, you know, somebody coming to a GP, I think, should be offered. Like our clients, we oftentimes think it would be really beneficial if they got, free gym membership, if they got advice on nutrition and where they had perhaps some vouchers where they could access healthy foods, because a lot of our clients eat unhealthily. Mm. And that is, we're focusing, because as I said, our third pillar is about holistic client development. We're looking at nutritional advice. We're looking at healthy eating. We're looking at activities. We're looking at adding meaning and structure to days and building support networks to alleviate boredom and loneliness and to help with fostering that kind of go-to person when you're in crisis. Before you get to crisis, actually, you have someone you can call and you have a mentor. You have somebody, you know, peer support, peer supporters who are there to help you. So wouldn't it be great if our clients or people out there who don't have the resources to access the best that they could, where they could have vouchers to go and access fruits and vegetables, where, you know, things can be simplified for them, where they can be supported to understand how important nutrition is and eating healthily is and exercising is to maintaining good mental health. And also to combating their, you know, illnesses like hypertension, like high cholesterol, like diabetes.
Mm.
There is we try to educate our clients, but it's very expensive to go out there and to have this, you know, access to this food. And lots of supermarkets throw away food. Lots of places, you know, there's a lot of waste that could be better utilized and. For people who need this.
I don't think it's just food. That's across many different mm-hmm. Avenues. There's a lot of waste. And again, this is where this compassion comes in. Ingrid, you're an intelligent, charismatic, I think you're amazing. And you could be working in the banking sector. You could be working in an environment that gives you a lot more financial wealth. I think that's fair to say. Why do you care so much about what you do?
God, look at where I've come from. I've been in it. I've been a part of it. I am it. This is my life. From the time I know myself, you know, I've lived with illness, with oppression, with disadvantages. And I'm very passionate, very, very passionate about being the difference and making the difference and ensuring that what I want for my brothers, what I want for myself, what I would have wanted for my mom and my dad and the people around me is what people have, people who are entrusted in my care. I look after my people, you know, talk to my employees and talk to my clients. Nothing is too big or too small for me to do, because I know that what an individual does for another person, you never know how far those efforts go. You never know the difference you're making in a person's life. You could be that person who stops someone from, you know, going to suicide. You could be that person who stops someone from, you know, absolutely relapsing and going into crisis where, you know, they hit out at another person, they do something that's detrimental not only to themselves but another person. I believe, you know, it's what I want to do. It's not, I could do other things, yes, but I feel that this is my calling and it's been my life all the time. I can't think of me doing anything else, you know, I just can't. I love my clients. I love my work. I love the people I work with. And I love seeing the difference that we make, you know?
Ingrid, thank you so much. And we will leave it there.